Haugen, Chair of the Washington Senate Transportation Committee. Thank you all for coming today. I think I'd like to just make a few opening comments. The Secretary of the Senate in Oregon, Judy Hall, has researched and come to a determination this is the first time that she has on record that a legislative committee from Oregon and Washington has met in session in the history of the state. So this is a really, truly a historic meeting, and really, really appreciate our colleagues from Washington, as we are all busy right now in our very busy sessions. And while we're planning and Oregon to try to learn from Washington, perhaps and adopt an annual session itinerary this session by closing out early and coming back with a mini session, we're learning from them, and they already have that established. And colleagues, they gavel out near the end of April. So we think we're fast-tracked right now. They get out in June. They're on a faster track. So I do appreciate the time that has been extended to us to come and join us today, because I understand how busy your itinerary is. We're here today to talk about the Columbia River Crossing, but most importantly, the reason, I believe, is to send a message not only to our respective states, but to our federal delegations and others, that we recognize how important to Washington and Oregon the economic vitality of our two states is with this ribbon of highway we call I-5, and that the infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, is going to be critical to the development of our states. And we want to make it very, very clear that our two delegations, Washington and Oregon, are committed to building and maintaining an infrastructure that serves our citizens and provides an economic boost and the ability to be a 21st century economy, and we are a Northwest economy, increasingly a West Coast economy, and that we're committed together. So welcome. I'd like to turn the gavel over to Senator Haugen and for her opening remarks, and to introduce the members of her delegation.
Well, I want to thank you for allowing us to come down and join you here. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to learn from each other about a project that really is going to be a joint project. And I can't say much more about the importance of our I-5 highway that connects not only our state but the entire West Coast, and how if we don't work together in dealing with these issues in the long term, we'll all suffer. It is really, you know, we have met with members from Oregon before, but never in a formal hearing when we were both in session. And certainly, I know I appreciate the fact that you would take time out of your hearing to come up here, too. It is very difficult to get away, and I'm really sorry that we weren't able to bring more members with us, but it was very difficult because we all do serve on other committees besides transportation. I am really privileged today to be joined with members of my committee, and especially Senator Craig Pragmore, who is the vice chair of Ways and Means. While we have a separate transportation budget in our state, unlike California, we deal with the budget besides policy in our committee. We all know that it's just not one type of money that may need to be a part of this big picture. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let my colleagues introduce themselves, and I thought I would tell that we'd each tell you where we're from. I actually represent the 10th Legislative District, which is right in the center of Puget Sound. I actually live on an island called Camano, and I represent Whidbey and Camano, which are the county that is entirely within Puget Sound. I also represent parts of Skagit and Snohomish County. Craig, go ahead.
I'm Craig Pridemore, Vice Chair of the Ways and Means Committee. I'm not actually a member of the Transportation Committee, but just so my bona fides are covered, I'm also a former Clark County Commissioner, former member of JPAC, former member of IMPACT, former founder, vice chair, and chair with my friend Rod Monroe of the Bi-State Transportation Committee, former chair of CTRAN, former chair of the Southwest Regional Transportation Council, former chair of the Southwest Washington Clean Air Agency, and a member of more bi-state organizations and efforts than I can count. Thank you.
Thank you. I am Senator Dan Swecker. I represent the 20th Legislative District, which is the district halfway between Seattle and Portland on the I-5 corridor. So we're very interested in the preservation and development of the corridor. It's vital for the economic interests of my district.
I'm Senator Don Denton. I've been a member of the Transportation Committee my entire tenure in the legislature, 2 years in the House and now 11 years in the state Senate. I represent the 17th Legislative District in Southwest Washington, which is mostly all east of 205. About 30,000 or so of my constituents every year contribute about $100 million into the tax coffers of the state of Oregon. So we're very concerned about how that money is spent. And so we hope to have some representation on those subjects. But I'm glad to be here, be working on this project. I believe the chairman and myself are the only two that were present at the last time that these two representatives from the legislatures got together about 10 years ago. And so I'm happy to see that we're doing it again, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
I'm Senator Chris Marr from the 6th Legislative District, which is Spokane. I am a vice chair of the Senate Transportation Committee. Although I'm new to the Senate, I did serve 7 years on the State Transportation Commission in Spokane, and then subsequent to that, 4 years on the Washington State University Board of Regents. I worked with Hal, so I'm a little bit familiar with some issues down here, but looking forward to this visit. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I will begin with the members of my Senate committee, and Senator George, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm State Senator Larry George. I represent Senate District 13, which is in the southern part of the Portland metropolitan area, represents from Wilsonville through Sherwood and throughout through Newburgh, where we have a lot of transportation issues, and was a lobbyist in the land use arena for about 10 years.
Senator Deckert.
Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Washington County and a little bit of southwest Portland.
I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I represent Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and Gresham. So even though we're always talking about I-5 corridor and 205, let's start thinking about corridor between Camas and Troutdale.
The muted applause in the background. And Vice Chair Starr.
Thank you. I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the senator from Western Washington County. And I have known Senator Haugen now for a number of years through our joint work at NCSL. I served as a vice chair under Senator Haugen when she was chair of the NCSL Transportation Committee. And last year and this year, I chair the NCSL Transportation Committee. I'm pleased that we were able to pull this kind of meeting together. I think it's critically important as we look at this bi-state relationship and this really critically important piece of infrastructure. So I'm very pleased that we were able to make this happen today.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Also joining with us today is Senator Rod Monroe, who's on our Ways and Means Committee, who was kind enough to join us today. Senator Monroe.
Thank you very much, Rod Monroe. And I have a list of former accomplishments even longer than Pridemore's, but I won't bore you with that. I've been working on transportation issues for my 30 years in state and local government, and especially proud of my work for 12 years on JPAC and as chair of JPAC and the Regional Transportation Council, and helped, along with Craig Pridemore, help form the Bi-State Committee, and also was able to travel to Olympia and meet with transportation officials up there in my previous capacity. Now I'm back in the Oregon State Senate and really enjoying things and working hard, especially on transportation issues.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. And also joining us as our guest today is the chair of the Oregon House Transportation Committee, Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really happy to be here, and I thank both chairs for allowing me to join you today. I am the House Transportation Chair. I represent House District 12, which would be Springfield, Mid-Willamette Valley, and I'm glad to be here.
And also with us, Senator Representative Byers, Vice Chair, Representative Dillon. Welcome.
Thank you. I represent District 55 in the House, and it's Medford. East of Medford goes to Lakeview and up to Prineville. We're quite a ways from this crossing, but we're vitally interested in it. It affects all of both of our states.
Thank you, Representative. And one other recognition in the audience that I will make is that I see the Senate Majority Leader has decided to come in to make sure we're doing good work. Senator Kate Brown, the Senate Majority Leader, welcome. Thank you for attending today.
There's a chair for
we do have some dignitaries and other people.
Yes, go ahead.
We do have some dignitaries being represented here today by their part of our delegation from Washington State, federal delegation. We have Mindy Lindquist representing Senator Murray. Do you understand? We have Kelly Love from Congressman Baer. And representing the governor is Jim Jacks. We really appreciate your being here. It's going to be a real team effort, not only by state, but also we need to have the federal government working with us also. Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to take a moment and introduce my staff coordinator, Mike Gresh. Thank you. And Natalie, who was with us, she runs our committee. She's our Senate staff.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Janet Atkins is the administrator for the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. And Janet, do we have anybody else from your staff?
Adam.
Man behind the curtain.
And Judith Callen's House Transportation.
Thank you, Judith, for coming as well. Also with us today, representing Congressman DeFazio, is Carmen Four. Carmen? Congressman Blumenauer's office, Eric Chambers, back there. Thank you for coming. And representing Governor Kulongowski is Chris Warner. I saw Chris. There he is in the back. Why do these guys always sit in the back, you know? It's like they feel guilty or something.
They think they're in church.
I think we'll begin. What we're going to do today is spend a lot on process. We have a good understanding of that. We've got great individuals and task force that are working on the particulars of it. What we want to talk about is the process and get us up to speed and any questions we have. Turn the gavel over to Senator Haugen to introduce our first speaker today.
Well, it is my honor to introduce our Secretary of Washington State Department of Transportation, Doug McDonald. Doug is an outstanding director. He came to our state. Doug, how many years have you been there now? It seems like 6 years. It seems like you've been there a lot longer than that. He's really been a man who's really taken charge. And he is going to be our first presenter today to talk about project overview process and sort of the course of action. So, Doug, if you want to come up, please.
It looks like we're going to do a joint presentation.
Yeah, so,
sitting with him will be Matthew Garrett, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and who formerly was the director of Region 1 in this area, worked with many, many times in many projects, and is carrying his great work through now as our director. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think Matt is, in fact, going to start.
I appreciate that. Chairman Metzger, Chairman Haugen, and members of the Joint Subcommittee, it's a pleasure for me to be here with Secretary McDonald. We are going to do our best imitation of Huntley Brinkley. We will share conversations here. I will give a quick introduction. Secretary McDonald will speak to some of the challenges that we face in this effort. Comes back to me to speak to some of the opportunities and some of the successes that we've realized to date, and then Secretary McDonald will close things up with a summary statement. So with that, again, this is an important day, and I truly appreciate the co-chairs this one.
Modern technology.
10-9, ha-ha.
It controls us. I truly appreciate the co-chair's opening statements, because this is a partnership. It's a partnership between all of us at the local, at the regional, at the state, and the federal level. So I believe we've kicked things off framing this in an appropriate manner. So we will share comments today. I would like to tell you that the Columbia River Crossing is a bridge project. It's a transit project, and it is a highway improvement project that the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Washington Department of Transportation are taking the lead on. The project is charged with addressing the congestion, mobility, and safety problems on this five-mile segment that stretches from roughly SR 500 up in Vancouver to Columbia Boulevard on the Portland side. And this area is known as the Bridge Influence Area. Now, the two states and the two state dots have had a long, successful, and solid history of building and working together, building bridges and working together, as well as maintaining those bridges across the Columbia River. And the most recent example is that's just about 10 miles east of here, which is the Glen Jackson Bridge. Now, I would argue that some of the best public and private minds have been working on this effort for roughly a decade. It goes back to the 1998, the Transportation and Trade Partnership, a substantial group of folks that came together that yielded an I-5 strategic plan that truly sets the tone and the direction for the conversation we're embracing today. The Columbia River Crossing is actually one of three projects coming out of that strategic plan. Happy to inform you the effort by our friends up at WSDOT, they've actually completed one of the projects mentioned in that strategic plan. That was the widening of I-5 to Salmon Creek. In 2008, the Oregon Department of Transportation breaks ground at Delta Park. As we widen the pinch point where I-5 now has two lanes, we will widen and bring in a third southbound lane and make some safety improvements with regard to shoulders on both sides. And the third project, again, is to find the solutions that deal with the congestion, safety, freight, and transit problems surrounding the I-5 bridge. And that's the work of the Columbia River Crossing. In November 2006, the project's 39-member task force forwarded the Columbia River Crossing staff's recommendation for a river crossing, a bridge, with transit options for the public to review and make comment on. These options include, again, one river crossing, that's a replacement bridge, and two high-capacity transit recommendations, bus rapid transit and light rail transit. And each of these transit options would be paired with an extended transit service to connect suburban Clark County with downtown Portland. Now, immediately after this November meeting, public comment period began. So we've been engaged in a very healthy listening session. It culminates February 27th when the task force meets. And the expectation is the task force will decide whether to approve or modify the staff's recommendation. I want you to know, again, it's been a comprehensive outreach effort. There have been four open houses held in Oregon and Washington. Roughly 350 citizens have attended to address, be introduced, and address the staff recommendations. And again, as I said, we've listened, heard their comments, and that's informed the overall discussion. Our staff is engaged in 37 community, neighborhood, civic-type meetings on both sides of the river. So with a task force decision that may indeed play itself out February 27th, we will move a proposal into the next stages, alternatives that will be further explored in more detail during the draft environmental impact statement. Now, Hal Dendring, the Chancellor of the Washington State University here in Vancouver, serves as a co-chair, and Mr. Dendring will share some thoughts about the important role this task force, as well as the decision-making process they're engaged in right now. He'll speak to you a little bit later. I think with that, that's the tee-up. I turn to my friend Secretary McDonald now to share some of the challenges that this project faces.
Transportation in Washington State is a litany of challenges.
Mr. McDonald, would you please just re-identify yourself for the record?
I'm the Secretary of Transportation in Washington State. Let me start by saying first that the opportunity to be here actually speaks not just to the issue that's presented by the communities here of how to deal with transportation needs in this area, which is ever expanding and ever growing, these areas, if you like, in two states. It is also a critical piece of the connection between both the states in their entirety. We came down the train today. We might just as easily have driven I-5 that comes all the way from the Canadian border through here and on its way south to California. It's critical for the economies of both of our states in their entirety, and past that for the entire West Coast and the country. I recently have been a couple of years the chairman or something of a group of the transportation agencies on the West Coast called the West Coast Corridor Coalition, which is looking at all of I-5 and all the rest of the issues around I-5 through the entire West Coast, looking for opportunities for federal funding, for federal support, and looking at the various areas along the corridor where it is critically important to us that we make transportation improvements necessary to serve not only our local communities but also our broader region and the national economy. So that the context for this project and for this meeting is even larger, I think, than what we bring to it just from the communities we are in. I want to say that the hallmark of this project from our standpoint at WSDOT, and I think I can say this for Matt and ODOT as well, is we live today probably in a different environment than we lived 10, 8, 10, 12, 15 years ago as to the urgency of the project delivery of programs by our transportation departments to put taxpayers' dollars to work and make the improvements that people want to see things happen to fix transportation obstacles and address needs. We have a real mantra in Washington State. Matt's got his own here about project delivery and accountability to get these projects done. And the way that has been reflected in this project is to put a project team together, which puts top people from both our departments together, a top consultant team, and really to put at the service of this project the resources necessary to move it forward. There has been, and that I think is a credit to our departments, a credit to the other individuals from the consultant teams, and I think it's a credit to the states and to you too, because it's been with your appropriation with some very important federal money that we've made progress that we've made to date and that we're going to need to make a lot more. What that means in day-to-day terms is that this project is on a schedule. Our people are working. We're trying to get the projects done. That is to say, the program elements, the environmental impact statement, the studies that need to be done, the intensive work of being up to talk to people about what the project needs to be and all the different communities that are affected. This project is not just kind of drifting along. We are trying to get to the point where, in short order, the project itself can happen. The project for us is building this and putting it into operation. We're in front of the project now. Our project is not to study. Our project is not to debate. Our project is to build the project. All of what we are doing now has to happen before that can happen, and we are on a mission to get that done. Now, I want to talk about a couple of the challenges, and in order to save time, I'm going to just go directly into them. One is one that I raised particularly because I know that our members from Washington State are very sensitive to it. Senator Howland has had more than a little experience with it. We have, on a project in Washington State, had a pretty difficult experience in the not-too-distant past with a project that unexpectedly ran into some very significant issues with Native American burials, the Native American community. The upshot of that was that by failure to adequately anticipate what some of those issues were going to be, a failure not only by ourselves but by the local communities and the tribes, we worked ourselves into a jam which was pretty expensive for us to work ourselves out of. Coming down to here, or we from Washington State are very sensitive that that issue not be repeated here. And the reason that it's important to note that is, and I don't know whether there's any representatives of the Native American community or the various tribes in the audience today, but there certainly is a huge involvement of the Native American community in this project. And the reason why that's so is that we are putting this project in a place that has long and deep significance to Native American peoples. And there are a whole series of project steps that involves us in, which we must take very seriously to get this project to happen. They include the protection of cultural resources. They, in all likelihood, may involve the discovery of burials, which will have to be dealt with in some places where this project lands on one side of the river or the other. And they involve an even more complicated feature, which we did not have in our referred to project up in Washington State, and that is the fact that there are several tribes, there are more than a few tribes involved in this project by virtue of the possibility that remains will be found or that legal rights will be invoked in some kind. And the most interesting and important of those legal rights is there are almost half a dozen tribes that under the treaty rights, which they have entered into as sovereign governments with the United States of America, there are legal rights in the Columbia River held by several tribes with respect to their customary occupations of fishing and gathering foodstuffs and other materials for their conventional or historic livelihoods and sustenance. This may seem like a small issue until you actually begin to explore it. And it's really quite a significant issue, and it's going to require a lot of work by all of us to make certain that we surmount the questions that are presented successfully. And I raise this for you because when we've talked about this issue a lot between the departments and in the project, and we had a long discussion just a couple of weeks ago, and we concluded the discussion by saying your presence all here today gave us the chance to lay a question on the table, which we have not got a satisfactory answer to, and we suspect you'll be interested in. And it's this, and I'm not going to name all the tribes or identify their extent, but I will say that because of the historic role of Fort Vancouver, it's a place where people came from all over what we think of today as the Pacific Northwest, and indeed, amazingly enough, from as far away as Hawaii, when this was a place that dispensed medicine and was a place where people could come to see. Nothing, a long historic occupation in this area prior to that. There are a lot of tribes involved in the issues here. And one of the issues that we are facing is that we are asking them to bring their resources to the expedited process that we are trying to conduct so that we can get these documents finished, we can get the studies done, we can get the arrangements for the projects completed as quickly as possible. And the tribes are asking us what support we can help to the professional and institutional work they must do to help us with our project. Now, I won't spin this out for you, but Oregon has had some historic relations with at least one tribe to engage in some forms of this kind of support. We have not in Washington State. Historically, we've asked tribes to support their own work in this. And given the scale of what's going to have to be done here and its importance to maintaining the project schedule, we're actually quite baffled at the question of whether we, as the departments representing you in all of this, should be working out arrangements with the tribes so that we can help support their professional work to move their process along at the same pace we are moving ours. This is something that I've identified to you because I don't think we can ask for an answer today, but whether legislatively or through guidance with your members in a consultative process, it would be very helpful to see if we can get a joint approach between the two states and with the several tribes to undertake in a uniform manner how we will work with the tribes on that. Now, in my own work in Washington State with tribes, one of the things I've learned is that it's not just Native Americans that have tribes. We ourselves often are tribes, and sometimes I find it illuminating and instructive to think of our own tribal relations amongst ourselves as being a convenient way to think about some of the other project challenges. Up in Seattle, those of you who followed the last few weeks have seen quite a tribal controversy around a project called the Alaskan Way Viaduct. No Native Americans have been involved to date, but we have had our tribes. And what, and without boring those, without repeating those of you who know what I'm talking about and are familiar with it, or boring those of you from Oregon who, believe me, don't want to know, I'll pass the Alaskan Way Viaduct situation and simply say that what's happened after quite a long and extensive and involved and highly professional and dedicated process of developing project alternatives and going through the project planning process, we have reached a fairly critical juncture at the project, realizing that, in fact, not all of that forged an agreement on fundamental questions about what the project was to do and be. And the fact that many meetings were held, many thousands of pages of material have been developed, and many millions of dollars have been spent in developing all that material, that in and of itself did not guarantee consensus at the critical point where we've got to see some consensus emerge. Now, I spoke with Senator Pridemore about a week and a half ago, and I'm still trying to figure out in what proportion of seriousness and in what proportion jest he advised me that in coming down here for this meeting today, we really ought to speak about the fact that in almost any of these large projects today, and certainly on this project, when you get past all the issues of process and all the things that the environmental scientists and so on are going to do in preparing the engineers and preparing their documents, we do have to find consensus about what this project is going to be before either of our departments or anyone else is going to successfully spend the money to produce the project. And so I am not the right person to speak of the things of which I'm not going to identify for you. But I do believe that in your coming down here and meeting together, it is really important that beyond all the progress that's being made, beyond the effort that's being devoted, and beyond the will to move forward that everyone shares, there are today some fundamental conflicts around this project about what it will be and do. And so we ask you to today consider what some of those conflicts are and think how, as the legislative bodies overseeing this entire process, you can help and anticipate and then prepare yourselves, if necessary, to respond to the question of how we will forge the consensus necessary to support a project. Now, at some risk, because I'm not the expert in this, I'll tell you what those conflicts are. The first of those conflicts is exactly what form, either and or, of transit is the right mechanism for the future of the communities involved in the region. And there is a extended discussion of that and some significant division among important people who have well thought out and well-grounded viewpoints about that. We have to solve that problem and achieve a consensus about that for the project to succeed. And there are real obstacles at the current time of seeing our way through to do that. Although I think people's interest in their commitment to the project means it will be done, but you ought to be watching it very carefully and aware of the seriousness of that discussion around the project. The other issue has to do with the fact that, as Matt has described, the process is quickly bringing us to the point where you start to narrow the focus of your inquiry. Issues or opportunities or suggestions about the project begin to fall away as the process seeks to narrow the opportunities to the ones that will ultimately be picked. Matt's talked about the meeting on February 27th where some of that work will be done. We have much consensus about many of the things that the project should achieve and probably are moving towards that narrowing in a successful way, but not everybody is on the program. And the reason that is so is that the actual fundamental idea of this project to expand the interstate capacity on I-5 across the river is adhered to by probably almost everybody, but not everybody. And as we look at that issue, we must be mindful of the fact that a program like this that passes that decisional moment without talking to people about how the analysis will be done and the questions answered from everybody who's coming at the project risks that the questions just come back later. And when they do come back later and they're not resolved, all of a sudden the program that you thought was ready to move ahead finds that it moved too quickly past discussion points that must be resolved, so people feel that that consensus can emerge. Now, lots of people in the community can speak about those issues far better than I can. But to do the program today about all the things that are going well and not know that those two issues really do have to be in your mind as you conduct oversight of the project would, I think, be a disservice to you. So there are some major challenges here, which is we're awfully welcome to have you here to look at because we expect and hope that your help will be instrumental in, fact, helping the project find answers to those tough questions.
What I'd like to do now is just speak to some of the opportunities, some of the successes that we've realized. And again, I'm going to speak of some of the things that are obvious, but I think it's key to remind everyone here that these issues will be a key ingredient to a successful solution to not only the transportation issues, but this economic challenge we face at the Columbia River Crossing. As I said earlier, we have some of the best and brightest public and private sector minds working these type issues. I think that is a necessity that will move us in the right direction. At the same time, I look to the federal level, and we are well positioned in both states, with Senator Murray positioned as a senior member on appropriation and a subcommittee chair for the Senate Transportation Appropriation Subcommittee as well. Mr. DeFazio, Mr. Baird sitting on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee with Mr. DeFazio chairing the Subcommittee for Highways and Transit. We have our two senators, Senator Wyden and Smith, sitting on the important finance committee that will deal with transportation issues. Congressman Blumenauer, just leaving the T&I committee, but moving to the powerful Ways and Means Committee, where he has indicated he will invest time looking at transportation issues, infrastructure issues on that committee. So we're well positioned in terms of federal, the federal delegation. And they are a partner. But to emphasize where Mr. McDonald went, you know, we need a shared vision. We need political commitment, and we need political consensus at all levels here in order for us to deliver the appropriate solution. I think those are givens, but it's important for us to remember that because we're going to have to position this conversation amongst all of us to deliver these solutions. Consensus is important. A couple other successes that have just played themselves out recently. The Columbia River Crossing has been identified as one of 14 projects along 8 corridors in the Corridors of the Future designation by the U.S. DOT. Again, here's an opportunity with this designation to accelerate review and conditional approval of experimental-type features under federal highway rules. They include kind of the coordination and a more efficient environmental review. we have access to some of the experts across the nation as well. And more importantly, there may be opportunities for potential discretionary funding. In the President's budget, he has set aside $25 million specific to the quarter of the Futures program. The second thing is we've worked in both states to bring the regulatory agencies at the state level and the federal level together to put the fannies around the seats, so to speak, so we can get out in front of any issues early in conversations to make sure as we move a project forward, we have all people on board early, so we're not hamstringing ourselves as we move to the end of a process. We have played this out, again, both the state of Washington and Oregon, by bringing that concept together and clothing in the garment of the Interstate Collaborative Environmental Process, or an INTERCEPT process, again, established to coordinate and streamline the regulatory reviews and permitting functions of all participating agencies. And again, those members include federal and state agencies responsible for protecting air, water, wildlife, and cultural resources. The committee does indeed provide advice and consultation regarding NEPA, the National Environment Policy Act, to our project team at the various formal concurrence points in the project. So they will use this streamlining approach, an approach that has served us well in Oregon and an approach that has served us well in the state of Washington. We have duplicated that specific to this project. I think those are the two quick hits I'd like to share with you. I'd like to turn to Doug now just to summarize the comment.
Yeah, I've learned one thing just in this partnership in the last 5 minutes. ODOT writes the talking points. Hundley has all the good news. You left all the bad news to Brinkley. I swear to God, the last talking point, which I'm not going to elaborate on because we have some people here who will tell you more about it, says, Doug, remind them that we don't know how to pay for the project.
That's nuts.
I think
that's fair.
Minor details. Before you leave, gentlemen, is there any comments, questions from any members of the delegation for either of these two?
Yes. I have a question.
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And I'll direct this, I guess, to both Matt and to Doug, but primarily to Doug. Doug, you said that it appears that we have much consensus and probably almost everybody is on board. And I was just wondering if you were aware that both Clark County in their official capacity and CTRAN, our transit district, have issued letters to the Washington State Department of Transportation raising serious questions about and objections to the process. And also several citizens have written a letter recently asking that February 27th date be put back because of serious, quote, serious flaws in the process of the public comment period. I just wondered if you were aware of that.
Yes.
Okay. And is there going to be a delay in that February 27th meeting to accommodate these concerns about flaws in the process?
I think the best way for me to respond to that is to refer that to Hal Dendrick, who is the chair of the task force. And I think that I can tell you this. There's been a lot of serious discussion about those letters and a lot of discussion about the fundamental problem we face. How do you move forward and at the same time leave no one behind in the process of, and that's a tricky issue. You put your finger on what some of the difficulty is. I actually think that on the question, I think that the issues you refer to go mostly to the question of how transit will integrate into this project and what form it will take. And I may have been thinking about the other issue when I said I think there's a, maybe everybody mostly agrees. I think there's a significant division on that. But I can't call that division in terms of percentage or in terms of how many votes there are in the task force or who's where on the issue. I think the question is, what's the nature of the discussion that, in the end, brings us all together on this? Because we can't build a project when nobody agrees upon it the day we try to break ground.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just tagging off of the Secretary's comments is, what is the process to get to consensus on the transit piece? Are we just going to continue to, inch our way forward and hope that folks get on board? Or what's the goal? Are we what steps are going to be taken in order to bring folks to that consensus point that we have to be at before, we really figure out how much the project's going to cost and then how we're going to fund it. Talk a little bit about, from your perspective, how do we get there? How do we get to the consensus point?
Your turn, Matt.
Mr. Huntley.
Good night, Chad.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, it's a long, hard process that we've been through. And again, I remind people that this isn't a current conversation. This is a conversation that's taken place decades. I think we have started with a significant universe of opportunity. And through the work of a lot of people, we continue to refine. And we come to a point now where we have three alternatives in front of us. Will we ever get to a point where everybody embraces it? I don't think so. I think in the work that you folks do, you never get at that point more times than not. Nothing different than what we do. All we can do is be comprehensive in our arguments, transparent in the way we conduct business, and I think Mr. Dendrink and his co-chair, Henry Hewitt, do just that. They allow all folks to come to the table to better inform the discussion. And at the end of the day, you have to have a thumbs-up or thumbs-down vote. Now, where Secretary McDonald is. I don't know where the number is where you say you have something to go forward. It's embraced by enough folks that this is a solution. All I know is, not only on a transportation scale, but on an economic scale, this is something that we cannot delay any further. The impacts to the health of the state of Washington and the health of the state of Oregon in terms of their economies, if not the whole Pacific coastline. This is in too important of conversation. So we'll continue to move forward. The votes will be taken. Obviously, it's one of those things, I guess you know when you see it, if you don't have enough hands go up on the yes side. But we're coming to a significant point, February 27th, that will dictate whether we move forward or we have to pause and reflect.
Governor Gregoire spoke with me about this project yesterday. This and a couple of others, our governor's position is that the one choice that is absolutely wrong is the choice that we can't do anything because we can't agree on what to do. That is a safety issue, and it's a huge drag on all of the communities who need the Columbia River crossing and the vitality of both the region and each of the, and the respective communities. I think the process of reaching agreement is I don't think it's the last person standing after everybody drops off by exhaustion and dismay and disgust, because all those people in fact come back just before you're going to vote the project. So that doesn't work. Everybody has to be there for the discussion. It seems to me that there are some trade-offs that are going to be involved. And one of the reasons it's useful to explore this with people like you is that as legislators, this is what you do every single day. And I think one of the things that will be helpful here is where political oversight, not just an institutional oversight, but truly your interest as leading people in the two state legislatures, you have got to help discipline this process and amongst yourselves talk about where are the trade-offs and the compromises and the legislative process of reaching decisions. You do this every single day. I think you can bring real leadership to this by, in fact, helping with us talk through some of these issues and get a shared vision for what the project will be.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And now I think I'll turn to Chairman Haugen to introduce and conduct our next panel.
Okay. We're going to hear about the economic perspective from our two ports. We have Bill Wyatt from the Port of Portland and Larry Paulson from the Port of Vancouver. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm sure you'll not only give us a port perspective, but you'll give us a trade, international trade perspective, too, I hope.
Indeed. Go ahead. Okay. If I can get this to work here.
Hmm.
Cool.
Really nice.
Great. Good. Well, Chairs Metzger and Haugen, thank you very much for making time available for us. Larry and I, this is our third visit this week together. We spent a lot of time together, which I think it's a good thing for all of us. And welcome to the Port of Portland. Glad to have you. We've been here for a while, not in this building, but certainly as an entity. I think the first chair of the Port of Portland right up here began office in about 18... 94, I think it was. So we've been in this business for quite some time. Chair Metzger had asked me to talk a little bit about the trade context for this bridge. And I think at one level it's fairly obvious. The interstate corridor is a vital corridor for business. But I think what may not be quite so obvious is the extent to which trade, the nature of trade, is changing and the impact that it's having on our transportation infrastructure. And that's really what I want to spend a little time with you talking about today. So, brief advertisement. This is essentially a picture of our facilities. On the left, you see the Columbia River. The island is Hayden Island. This end of it we own, West Hayden Island. And then you can see Terminal 6, our container facility, and then our various terminals up the Willamette River on the right. We also own Hillsborough Airport and the Troutdale Airport, and Senator Anderson's district further out. And so you get a kind of a perspective about our physical connection here. Our two ports are not actually connected, but in so many ways they are, because we share the same very important infrastructure, not the least of which is the Interstate 5 corridor. So, you know, I always get a little skeptical when I see these straight line charts forecasting trade, except that if you were to go further to the left, you'd see that it just continues on. And this gives you a sense about the expectations which have been met historically about the growing dependence on trade-related activity. And this involves both imports and exports. And I think for our states, this is important because we're both very trade-dependent states. Nothing tells me that's going to change. Our little container terminal that you saw there has about an equal number of loaded containers coming in with loaded containers going out. We're a major export center for agricultural products and other goods, and I think that will continue. So trade is going to continue, obviously, to play an important part, and as a percentage of overall economic activity, it's going to grow significantly. And that relates specifically to the transportation system. So you can see these forecasts, which come from several different sources. The western region is going to experience a higher percentage of volume increases than any other part of the country, and that is largely due to our proximity to the Pacific Rim. And the primary growth areas are certainly on the Pacific Rim, and the west coast is the closest by distance. Now, this is, I think, an interesting chart. And so when it says Portland, think Portland-Vancouver, because it's one region. And you can see on the left a chart that shows freight flows by origin. And these are not intended to reflect volumes, but intended to reflect growth. Okay, so here our region is shown as an area that will be a primary growth region in terms of volume export or flow export. And on the right, you can see that we also expect to grow significantly based on this forecast in terms of freight coming into this region. This region has historically been a distribution-centric area, and it has a lot to do with the very institution that I have the pleasure of representing in many ways, in the legislature for creating the port to construct this navigation channel back in 1891. Larry and I were on a panel the other day. I said, you know, if you're doing this all over again, you probably wouldn't build the port 107 miles up the Columbia River, but they did. And because they did, we now have two interstate freeways, two transcontinental railroads, and a over-dependence on trade-related activity. All of that has occurred and developed over some long period of time, and I think this is a reflection of the fact that we have this extraordinary talent, this infrastructure, and this economic force here that is built around trade. This is intended to give you kind of a scale, if you will, and you can see Seattle and Portland, both fairly significant bubbles on the national scale. And as you'll see in a moment, of course, both very, very dependent on the I-5 corridor. I asked the staff to put this picture in just to, as a kind of a symbolic reference. Of course, on the one hand, it's a ship, it's a container ship, and it's at what last month was America's fastest growing container port, I might add, and small scale. But the important thing about this picture is this is the warehouse of the 21st century. So these boxes contain goods from all over the world. And what no consignee, what no owner of the freight wants to do is have it sitting in a warehouse. Nobody wants to pay the inventory cost of that anymore, and they don't need to. And so this is the warehouse. These boxes come off. They go on trucks. They go on the road. They go to distribution centers, and distribution centers are not warehouses in the old-fashioned sense of the word. Everything is always moving, and I think that's the thing I want to just keep at the top of your mind is that this world is changing. Just-in-time manufacturing needs just-in-time distribution, and that's what this is all about. So Columbia Sportswear, which has their major distribution facility out on our property next to the container facility, this is kind of their basic model. One thing to note is they use all modes. They use planes, they use trains, they use ships, and they use a lot of trucks. And you'll see a little more about the truck business here in a moment, but the freight on the left there, it arrives at our terminal, or it could easily be at Seattle or Tacoma. All comes down here. It collects in one place. The containers are unstuffed. When you open a container door, you don't see, you know, tennis shoes or clothing. You just see a wall of cardboard. So all that has to come out. It moves. It shifts. It changes based on where the end consumer is. It goes perhaps to the distribution center, perhaps directly to the retailer who themselves may have an additional reload facility, and then off to distribution wherever, and it could go right back on the water again. This is really the model, at least of the early part of the 21st century, and it is very dependent on multimodal connections and very dependent on trucks and freight systems. So this just gives you a sense about that multimodal connection and some of the major export commodities and products. And you can see grains, for example, dependent on rail, barge, ship, minerals, on truck, rail, ship, electronic equipment, truck, rail, ship, air, and so on and so forth. You can see food products, for example, use it all. We export an awful lot of seafood from this region that goes by air freight to Asia and to other parts of the world. And just reinforcing that, the truck connections are really what are incredibly important here, because that is what creates that last mile connection in some cases, but also is how the freight is moved to the major hubs like Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, up and down the West Coast. So just to give you some kind of sense of this, there are about 14,000 trucks daily on this segment of I-5. About 60 to 70 train moves daily. We had a hard time nailing this number down because we're not talking about a train move from one terminal to another. We're talking about major mainline movements of freight rail, both of the Western Transcontinental rail providers serve this region. And shipments on an annual basis equal a value representing about a third of the metropolitan area gross product. So this is a very, very important corridor. A little busy, I apologize for that, but just to give you a sense about some of the companies, some of the commodities, and the modes of transportation they typically use here, which I think if you just kind of look over at that left-hand Willamette Valley, Western Oregon box, by example, HP, WaferTech, Intel, they're using air, they're using truck, they're using ship. Xerox, SEH America, same thing. Go down to North Pacific, Roseburg, building materials, they're using everything. They're using air, they're using truck, they're using rail, they're using ship, and so on and so forth. So by tonnage, you can see here the role the trucks play. They carry almost 64% of the weight, if you will, the total volume of weight of cargo that moves in and out of this region. not to say that pipelines and air and ocean and barge and intermodal and rail aren't important. They're incredibly important because those are the connecting points, but this gives you some perspective about the role of trucks. By value, even greater. Trucks carry a larger segment of the value of the freight flows that move in and out of this area. And again, these other modes are very, very important because of the connection they provide. The trucks continue to play a very, very important part of this. So here, the thickness of these lines are an indication about the volume of flow, and you can see the role that I-5 plays here. This is the Portland region. Here's Seattle. I'm just going to kind of go back and forth here, kind of get a sense for it. Portland, Seattle, Portland, Seattle, Portland. Pretty similar. Our rail corridors we share as well in this region. Both Larry and I share the same networks, despite the fact that we're on separate sides of the river. And you can see Washington's primary rail corridor, same thing. Get a sense for that. So I-5 is one of the most, this is a little tight, difficult to see, but if you can sort of see the Straits of Juan de Fuca and kind of move down to the center part of Oregon there, you get a sense about I-5 on a national scale. Of course, the East Coast is more congested because it continues to contain a larger segment of the nation's population, but it is telling to see that thick red line that bridges Oregon and Washington and goes to, on down to California. So there is a financial effect of this, obviously. A dollar in 1 minute sitting in traffic equals a dollar in wasted fuel and lost productivity. This is the result of a fairly substantial study that has recently been completed in this region on the cost of congestion. In 2005, we had about 32,000 vehicle hours of delay. By 2030, at the current plan of improvement, we expect about seven times that amount as is the case today. So this is obviously a very, very important development for our regional economy, and I mean our region broadly writ, from the northern border of our country on through our state of Oregon. This corridor is absolutely vital. The dependence on trade is greater, and trucks are playing an even more important part in that. And so I wanted to just leave you with that perspective, and am now pleased to turn the microphone over to my colleague.
Senators, representatives, and those in the audience, thank you for giving us a few moments of your time. We did divide this up a little bit, and I have a handout as opposed to a PowerPoint, if I may get a little help, Mike. Thank you. Bill said he would handle the trucks, and he left me the transit issues. Wasn't that the deal?
Yeah.
The Columbia River Crossing, the I-5 bridge, is actually more than just a vehicular issue, at least for the ports. A little background on the Port of Vancouver might be helpful, particularly in context, which you see the Port of Portland, which has not only air, frankly, is larger in container operations that we do not have. The Port of Vancouver is primarily a bulk, break bulk, and autos facility. We are the West Coast import location for Subaru. Our bulk products are primarily agricultural wheat and some mineral products. About 70% of our cargoes actually is export wheat. And, of course, break bulk, things that don't go in containers, steel, lumber, aluminum, those sort of things that those of us that grew up in the Northwest never thought we'd import, but now we do more of that. Be that as it may, our modal split, how we divide up what we deal with, is also different. The Port of Vancouver is about 70-plus, maybe 72% currently rail-dependent. And so I will deal with that in just a little bit, too. We are about 16 to 18% dependent upon barge and only about 10% or so dependent on truck. That still means we deal with about 200,000 trucks per year. And that will grow along with the rail and other issues that I want to at least talk about a little bit as we go through. And just for purposes of tracking, and this may be redundant if you will bear with me a little bit on the Washington side, as we look at rail, there are four and only four main rail lines through east-west from the northwest. At the top of the map that you have before you is Stevens Pass. Stevens Pass is approaching capacity in the 2010-11-12 time frame, is limited by grade, tunnel, and sidings. Stampede Pass has many of the same limitations, as well as is not capable of double-stack trains, particularly out of the Puget Sound area, and as a result only carries 6 to 8 trains per day. Now, there is a proposal in the state of Washington to perhaps move forward with Crown cutting that, yet to be determined in this legislative session. The other two would provide the main growth potential are on the Columbia River on both sides. BNSF on the north and UP, Union Pacific, on the south. Both serve our respective areas and in particular our respective ports. And in particular, that main line east-west travels underneath the Columbia River I-5 bridge and is something that I point out needs to be protected on a longer-term basis. Currently, about 46 trains per day travel that. It is projected by 2025 that that number will reach 70. I wanted to also mention this in the context of what the Port of Vancouver is looking to do over the next 5 years. If you move to the next handout that I've given you, by perspective, that orange line is a proposed new access into the Port of Vancouver to better serve not only the port itself, but to reduce congestion on the main line, and it too will connect just about where the I-5 bridge is. I mention this because the perspective of maintaining the rail traffic is very important as we look at the crossing, which, by the way, we do support. This particular realignment will result in 40% less congestion in 2025, not only for the port but for the main line, than we have literally today. And why are we interested in this? Next slide shows areas where the Port of Vancouver over the next 5, 6, 7 years will probably, we believe, have an opportunity to double or perhaps 2.5 times the size of the current activities of the port now. We anticipate going from about 45,000 rail cars per year to as many as 160,000 in that time frame. That will mean an investment for our community of about $200 million total to try and build out what we believe is an appropriate port for the future. And I say that knowing full well that we're also dealing with and working with the Port of Portland, in looking at the overall freight picture for our region. And in fact, Bill is very much aware of our plans and what we're trying to look forward to into the future. I should also mention barge lines. There are just under 10,000 barge trips per year up and down the Columbia River that pass and traverse underneath the I-5 bridge. That number is likely to also increase as time goes on, and we project that it will. Bridge lifts, as any who have had to wait as the bridge has gone up and down, will right now cause a significant delay, significant time to clear, and significant commitment of economic resources that sit there waiting in that traffic. What is it, $1 a minute for stays? We are convinced that the need to replace the bridge is also tied to the bridge lifts and the amount of barge traffic that continues to use the Columbia Snake River system and meets the needs of a lot of people as far away, believe it or not, as Minnesota and Nebraska, who ship product to our respective ports for delivery around the world, in particular the agricultural products. Lastly, I want to talk about the interchanges and the freight access. The ports have a concern to be sure that care is used long-term so that we can connect. I mentioned 200,000 trucks per year. What was it, Bill? 14,000 per day?
Daily, yeah.
The way we connect to I-5, the way the details are worked out, the way on our side of the river that we use Mill Plain, Fourth Plain, and any other routes to and from the river, or to and from the freeway, are going to be important. Now, I say that knowing full well, at least from our perspective, that we will continue to be more rail-dependent as time goes on. In 2025, we anticipate being 80% or more rail-dependent. That's the type of cargo we deal with. At the same time, there will be increases not only for trucks but for people who are working at the port. Right now, we believe there are 15,000-plus jobs related to port activities, about 5,000 direct and indirect jobs. Because of the anticipated growth, we anticipate that will also double in that time frame. The ability to use that route, and I-5 is, as Bill noted, in the big thick red lines demonstrated, our concern to be sure that we are able to move our cargoes out and into our community, and for that matter, from our community to our ports and docks and out to the rest of the world. Again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak, and I suppose questions?
I'm sure.
We have some questions. First, I have a question. As being someone who isn't real familiar with this, how long is the delay right now during your rush hour?
Well, answer this, but I'm reasonably certain that today the Coast Guard has actually granted special dispensation during certain times of the day, so there are no lift stands or no lifts. But that's not going to go on forever. And I think to give you a sense of this, were a new bridge to be constructed with a lift span, I would be surprised to see FHWA or the Coast Guard, more particularly, allow that policy to continue, because it's very unusual for them. So I'm not sure what the delay average is today related to lift spans, because I think it doesn't actually occur during the rush hour.
Senator George has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was noticing, Bill, in your presentation, we were talking a little bit about the congestion, the bottleneck that we have right here. And my own personal company, we send most of our freight through the Port of Portland, but we also put them on trucks and go through the Port of Tacoma and ports north. So we have a lot of through traffic through here. I was under the impression before yesterday when we had a presentation for our committee that this whole project was headed towards a direction of a third bridge or a third route across the Columbia to expand capacity. And so I'm new to this. So enlighten me a little bit, because I know you're on the task force. I am so afraid of the bottleneck that we have right through this area. I'm trying to figure out how some of the proposals that are going forward really relieve the freight traffic, and why we wouldn't talk about, if we're going to expand, either a freight corridor or some other corridor outside of this one. Because I see if you improve, even if you change this bridge, if we take out the existing bridge, all we do is move the bottleneck slightly south or slightly north, and I'm coming from Mid-Willamette Valley. So if you could enlighten me a little bit about how this would actually help us move freight through this bottleneck, I'd be really appreciative.
Well, I think, for starters, you have to do more than just build a bridge. And I think Matt referenced this earlier and has been very much a part of this discussion. I think I met Senator Pridemore for the very first time, my very first public meeting after going to work here at the port, at the I-5 Trade and Transportation meeting, which has sort of continued on in various forums. And there are so many related items that have to travel together. The bridge is one, but frankly, the intersections on both sides are absolutely vital, so that the Marine Drive intersection, for example, on this side, or Columbia Boulevard, and back yourself all the way up, all of those are extremely important, and the bridge will do nothing to improve those bottlenecks. And so
The bridge is important, but it's not the only feature which governs congestion. As far up as Ridgefield, for example, what kind of development occurs there? What kind of infrastructure is in place to manage that? All of that is very, very important. Now, I'm satisfied that a replacement bridge without the lift span and improvements along the corridor itself will make a huge difference. But the, I don't know the extent to which your committee has examined the price tags that are associated with all of this, but that's obviously a factor in thinking about significantly expanding congestion. I think there are people, as you may know, here in this region who favor an option with no new bridge, use the existing infrastructure. And I wouldn't say that they're a majority by any stretch of the imagination, but their voice is going to come forward. And so I think it's important that there appears to be a growing consensus about a new structure to begin with. But most importantly, we cannot forget about the bottlenecks that occur miles on either direction, because if you just build the bridge and don't deal with those, or deal with those and don't build the bridge, you really haven't addressed anything.
Go ahead.
May I add one comment? I happen to concur with my Willamette University classmate, Senator Manus Anderson, that longer term we may have to look at another bridge. And we on our side of the river have at least started a discussion about that. But what we have is the I-5 bridge before us, and the issues related to it and the issues related to how we get to and from the bridge, and Bill covered them well, and we concur.
If I could follow up.
Okay, one thought.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern is that I was really caught off guard that we're actually talking about just replacing current infrastructure, and I was really expecting the proposal coming from the task force to be more towards where the new corridor would go. And basically not, and I think it's going to be difficult to explain to constituents how we are going to spend $2 to $6 billion and then rip out existing infrastructure. And I was just wondering, in the future plans of both the ports and Ports North, obviously, for my personal situation, why are we not talking about actual new corridors at this point if we're talking about a $2 to $6 billion? And I just would like to know the background, because I'm not saying it's wrong. I just would like to understand this is a huge price tag. Mm-hmm. And all we're doing is replacing, and I don't see that much more capacity, and I see it just filling up. So I'm wondering why we're not talking different corridor.
This might be the wrong panel to be asking.
Okay. No. Well,
freight-wise.
Get your wallet out.
Yeah. No.
Okay. Go ahead.
I would say there are issues related to earthquake, seismic issues, cost of maintenance, and a number of other things, but you're right. This is not my expertise. Defer it to someone else.
There is a structural issue, I believe, with the bridge, and perhaps somebody will talk to about us about that.
It's, I think the first thing anybody needs to know is that the original bridge was built in 1917, and, it's not going to be with us forever.
Other questions? Senator Benton has a question.
Thank you. Well, most of the bridges in Washington State have seismic retrofit problems, so That's not a new issue. But my question is, a few years ago, we thought it would be a good idea, we meaning a lot of people in the community, and you guys remember this, I'm sure, that it would be a good idea to construct a port-to-port bridge that would exclusively serve ports, maybe take the freight traffic off of I-5 a little farther north, somewhere between Ridgefield and North Vancouver, Salmon Creek, bring them across, just a separate freight corridor, if you will. And that's not talked about much anymore, and I'd like for you to address that and how that might relieve the congestion, and also the fact that the Federal Highway Administration has said that adding an existing lane to the 205 would remove more congestion entirely than replacing the I-5 bridge well, and why we're not talking about that option as opposed to replacing I-5 bridge in a corridor that's, what you pointed out, has many, many choke points on the corridor, not just the bridge.
If I may, Senator Benton, taking your questions in reverse order, I don't really know anything about the I-205 issue. But going to the issue of bridge or port to port, that has been a discussion. We've had some interesting back and forth about it.
But as a practical matter, the ports of Portland and the ports of Vancouver do different things. And we really don't connect in terms of what their trucks do or our trucks do going back and forth. We serve different customers. We serve different locations. It's not, as we looked at it as objectively as we could, not a good real fit for the ports themselves. We also had a concern about the likelihood, considering 14,000 trucks a day, they do a little more than we do. How do we deal with those trucks that come into Vancouver and then pass through the neighborhoods? I get a little heat right now for our trucks going through, and no offense to Bill, but I would get concerned about 14,000 or some of those going through our neighborhoods connecting at some point to I-5. You also raised the issue about access up in the Ridgefield area. There was a proposal to do that, and to extend 501, which I think you're familiar with,
yeah.
Out along Lake River and tie it into Ridgefield. There's a significant state and federal reserve out there that poses some significant problems related to that kind of activity, and in fact that choice was abandoned in the early 1990s.
One last question, Senator Moreau.
Now, for Larry primarily, Larry, I was surprised in your presentation you didn't talk about the rail bridge and the needs there. My understanding is that rail bridge is the most congested rail bridge in North America. It's old, it's slow, it requires some weaving of barges as they come under the highway, I-5 bridges, and then have to weave over and make it through the rail bridge. And there's been a considerable discussion about the need to replace and expand that rail bridge. Can you comment?
Well, I was trying to keep my comments to the I-5 bridge, but Bill mentioned that the first bridge on the I-5 bridge was 1917. The rail bridge was built in 1908. It was built for sternwheelers. Longer term, I think that issue does have to be addressed and should be addressed, and there is a safety issue with the current bridges because of the need to try and avoid those lifts. So the barges tend to go through the middle of the I-5 bridges and then make a very quick S-turn to try and line up with the rail bridge, which has a swing access and narrow swing access, I might add, to line up and go through both to the Port of Vancouver and to the Port of Portland. That does, I think, long-term, and even in the short-term, represent a safety issue, and I am hopeful that we can work on that probably as a separate issue other than the I-5 bridge itself. But long-term, it does need to be dealt with.
Just a quick follow-up. When I was chair of JPAC, we were trying to deal with this, and we were trying to get some Truman Hobbs money.
Yes.
The testimony was that we didn't get the Truman Hobbs money because our pilots were too good, because they made it through and they didn't bang into that bridge a couple of times. That if there had been a couple of accidents, so to speak, that then we might have been eligible for that Truman Hobbs money, which says a little bit about the way the federal government funds things.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I've actually fished with one of your pilots, and they are pretty good navigators. So I'm going to turn the gavel back over to my counterpart, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Chairman Haugen. We have Hal Dingerink. And Bill, are you going to be joining him as well?
Thank you.
Thank you. Is this the one that's working? Okay. Chairs, members of the committee, I am Hal Dingerink. I am Chancellor for Washington State University here in Vancouver. A psychologist by training, not a transportation expert by any means. I agreed to co-chair this task force for a whole variety of reasons. Part of which was because I didn't know what I was getting into. My co-chair for this is Henry Hewitt, who has a great deal of experience on the Oregon side and with the prior processes here as well. And it may be part of his experience that led him not to be here today, knowing that people were going to dump the difficult questions off on us. That being as it may, let me give you a little bit of background about this particular project. It relates, I think, to some of the questions that have been raised here. Our task, as it was made very clear to us, is a very limited task. And that is, we were titled as the Columbia River Crossing Task Force, as we were to deal with the I-5 bridge, okay, not to deal with all of the transportation issues in the entire region or all of the issues that might involve crossing the Columbia River, for that matter. In other words, it was not our task to look at bridges that might occur other places, either up or downstream. In fact, we concur that there may be a need for other bridges, either up or downstream, or possibly both, sometime in the future here. Okay. Whether that's Camas Troutdale or some other connection, I don't know. Okay. In fact, the task force has looked at this and has asked the Regional Transportation Commission to look at additional alternatives. Okay. But even if we solve this or try to address other problems in this region, by creating bridges that might be either upstream or downstream, we'll still have a problem on I-5. Okay. Part of the reason why this particular area is problematic is because during peak hour traffic, 70% of the traffic either gets on or off or both within the bridge influence area. So that doing things such as widening 205 may solve some of the through traffic kinds of issues. Trucks that come, you say, from Seattle all the way down to Los Angeles could avoid the Portland downtown area as a result of all of that. It won't solve the problems with the traffic that gets on or off within the bridge influence area. Okay. It's because of what's there, the manufacturing, the ports, the retail that is there within this bridge influence area that drives a lot of the problems. Okay. This corridor in itself is not big enough, however, to take care of all of the problems. We can't solve that with three lanes of freeway either direction, and that's what we connect to on either side. Three lanes in the north, and certainly with the Delta Park project later on, three lanes on the south end of this project. So our task, okay, was limited to dealing with the I-5 bridge. Okay. Not just the bridge itself, but transit-related kinds of issues with it as well. The task force that was created for this is an extremely diverse one. It is one that involves interests related to trucking, related to retail. Several local governments are represented on the task force. Groups such as Coalition for a Livable Future, certain neighborhood groups, the ports are represented on this task force. The maritime industry, certainly the barge industry folks are part of all of this. Rail folks are part of all of this, and we have had constant public input as well. Okay. It is an extremely diverse task force because of the fact that we are dealing with two different states and because there are a number of different interests that come together around this particular effort. All of the members of the task force actually were appointed because they represented a given constituency, not necessarily because they were there to solve the particular problem, but rather to represent the interests of their given constituency. That makes it difficult. Okay. And it means that this has been a noisy process. Okay. It has been one in which there has been a great deal of discussion. More meetings than a lot of us ever thought we were going to have, much longer meetings than a lot of us ever thought we were going to have as part of all of this. Okay. It's a process with a lot of different opinions, a lot of discussion, a lot of exchange of ideas, not unlike, okay, as somebody pointed out earlier, the legislative process. It's not unlike what I've seen in the Senate chambers, for that matter, in Washington, the discussions that you folks have had there. Okay. Still, that does not mean that we haven't made progress. In fact, I think we have made considerable progress. We have agreed on the problem definition. Okay. We've agreed on a set of values. We've agreed on the outcomes, the measures that we want to assess to determine what the likely success of this particular project is likely to be. The decisions have been largely data-based, not entirely so, but certainly I think for the most part, okay, data that staff has been able to produce for us or that previous efforts have brought together for all of this. Okay. It's not been a problem because of the two states, okay, but because of the myriad of interests that are represented on both sides of the river of various sorts. Okay, have made it difficult. Okay. We are at a point in the process where taking our various measures, all of the suggestions that have been put on the table either by members of the task force or by the staff or by members of the public, okay, where we have received a recommendation from the staff, okay, that we look at in their proposal three different alternatives. One is a no-build alternative. Okay. One is an alternative that we replace the two existing bridges with new facilities, okay, and add to that light rail to deal with the additional transportation issues there of passengers going back and forth. The third alternative also involves a recommendation of replacing the two existing bridges and adding to it bus rapid transit to deal with the other high-capacity transit issue. Okay. There was some implication earlier that there may be a fourth alternative coming forth. There may very well be. Okay. Our process is not one in which we simply watch what the staff does. Okay. It has been really a decision-making group. It is one that has invited additional input about all of this, and it is quite conceivable that there will be another piece that will be put onto the table at our meeting next week. Okay. Our process has been, as I say, more extensive than a lot of us anticipated. It's been more extensive than a lot of people have wanted us to. A number of folks asking us to hurry up. Admittedly, there have been some other folks who have suggested that the process has been too fast. I will tell you that that is a minority opinion. The majority of folks think that we have been spending too much time doing all of this. If we've done so, it's been because we have attempted to be thorough, okay, in examining all the various alternatives that could be part of all of this. With that, I'm ready to take questions unless Bill wants to add to that description of the process.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all your hard work. Mr. White was also a task force member, and since Harry Drew couldn't be here today, Bill is pinch hitting for any questions. Mm-hmm. We had some questions earlier, and again, we're trying to move through the program to make sure everyone has an opportunity to hear from folks, so we'll try to have two or three questions and move on. And I think I have one right here, Senator Benton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Hal, I appreciate your explanation. But it seems to me, you know, when you close with a statement, we've examined all the alternatives. Of course, we have to understand that that's in context of your original statement, which is our task was to look at the I-5 bridge.
Correct.
So we haven't examined all the alternatives that may be beyond that task, that very narrow task. And so I guess my question for you is, has the narrowness of the task created some of these problems? And I know that in talking to other people in the task force that they wanted to look at third bridges. You said that you've recommended to the RTPO that they look at the region as a whole and that you concur in the needs for other options. That has, I would guess, has made it difficult for you because the task was very narrow at the outset.
I would suggest to you, though, as well, that the narrowness of the task has also made it easier. We have looked at the impact of other crossings. You know, we've looked specifically at increasing capacity on 205. We've looked at what might happen if we create additional crossings either upward or downstream. And it's not that those other crossings aren't beneficial or maybe even necessary, but the question was, would it solve the problem that we have on the current I-5 bridge in that corridor? Okay. And all of the data that we've been able to generate, that the staff has collected, leads us to the conclusion that no, they will not solve this problem.
And let me just follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair, to that point. Are the recommendations coming from the CRC task force then adequate to solve the problems of congestion in the I-5 corridor?
First of all, let me tell you that we do not have our recommendations yet. What we have are recommendations from the staff about what alternatives we will proceed with. Okay. And we'll proceed with those in a fashion that looks at all of the data as we look at where we can put things and how large they might be and all of those kinds of things here on what they'll impact they'll have.
You're down to three, though, right?
In terms of the staff recommendations. As I said, will there be a fourth? I would suspect there may very well be by the time we finish next Thursday. But our intent clearly, all right, is to evaluate these in terms of whether they improve traffic on the I-5 corridor, okay, in a whole variety of different measures. Will it solve it totally? I doubt it, okay? That's part of the reason why we've suggested that ultimately we're going to need to look at other issues. If we cannot come up with an alternative that does not significantly improve the current or particularly the projected congestion in this corridor, I'm certain that our recommendation will be no bill.
Thank you.
This is a very, very good question because I think, as you point out, the context within which the task force has operated has been constrained. And I think that was a good thing. Having served on the original trade and transportation partnership, my frustration with this process was, oh boy, we get to do it all over again. And fortunately, the mission did get somewhat constrained so that we didn't have to rehash all of those arguments. But I guess my view is this will improve things significantly. I'm not sure that it will solve the problem entirely because the problem has so many other dimensions. There, you know, and this is a sensitive subject, I know, but there are huge land use implications to this kind of infrastructure. When you put $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion into infrastructure, it has an impact on land use. People want to take advantage of that for the obvious reasons. And so I guess my answer would be we probably don't really know whether this problem will ultimately be solved because there are so many of those variables out there that have yet to be addressed. And I think if you know, the city of Portland chose to take the Portland Meadows area, for example, and turn it into high-density retail, why build the bridge? You know, why waste our time and our energy? This is even more sensitive, but just drive down 50 miles, you Portland area legislators who make this commute every day, see it, to the Woodburn exit and see how we essentially appropriated public infrastructure to a private development. And so those are challenges that at some point are going to have to be addressed. We're not part of the task force's responsibility, but if you're going to invest this kind of money, you also got to pay attention to its lifespan based on those kinds
that's
of challenges.
That's my concern. Yeah.
We're going to go to Senator Stark, Senator Montanson, and then we're going to move on to the next panel. Let's keep us on task here.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is relates to maybe the gorilla or the elephant that's in the room, and that's the flavor that funding has played in your deliberations. We're talking about a range. You know, we hear this $2 billion to $6 billion range. Is your deliberation completely separate from what this is going to cost, or is that playing a role in your decision? Are you going to come up with the preferred alternative and say, this is what we think ought to be built, and we don't, you know, whether it's $2 billion or $10 billion, that's not our charge. And along with that conversation, if you have had the conversation about funding, where does tolls play a role in that conversation? And not only tolls, but tolls not only on the I-5 bridge, but on I-205 as it relates to overflow.
Ooh. Yeah. This is not a short question. I'll try to make it a short answer as much as I can. Number one, cost is an important consideration in a whole variety of ways. Okay. We do not have enough information yet to tell you what all the costs are going to be, but we do know, for example, that one solution such as adding additional bridges, supplemental bridges, means we're taking more ground, right, more right-of-way, for example. That increases the cost. Okay. cost in terms of the construction of it, whether we have, you know, how we go about building the bridge, whether it's going to cost us more for one particular design or another, is another issue as well. But yes, cost is an important factor and will be important in reaching our ultimate conclusion here. Okay. We have had some discussion about tolls, and let me point out that tolls are extremely complex kind of a discussion. It's not simply a matter of driving across the bridge and throwing a quarter in the basket. Okay. There are a large number of variables to all of this, particularly in kind of modern technology. We have, again, only begun to talk about tolls. This will be an important discussion here. We've had some discussion about whether or not that means simply shifting traffic off to 205 and what the implications of that might be. But I was on a toll bridge in Baltimore that you could see a bridge right next to you that was not a toll bridge, okay, and it was working in there. It was a little faster on the toll bridge, so I don't know if that's an issue or not, okay. But what my understanding, in fact, though, is that we, according to federal law, cannot toll the 205 bridge in order to solve an I-5 bridge problem.
Without some change.
Yes. Okay. But those are important things we're going to be looking at very definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I'm talking about this project with various community members and other legislators also, one question comes up. We have so many bridges in Oregon. I think we have 11 over the Willamette that have seismic problems. Yet we're going to get rid of the existing bridge. And people, their gut reaction is, why get rid of that bridge? Yes, we definitely need this new bridge, but why get rid of that other one? And can you tell us a little bit about the process thinking that came out of the committee on that?
Yeah, and a lot of the background behind all of this is really perhaps more a question for the staff than for me. As I said, I'm not a transportation guy in any sense. But first of all, the seismic issues are important, okay, it doesn't make sense to me that we would say let's leave them all in condition where they may fall down and not address this one, okay, because the rest of them are, you know, in trouble here. We're going to have to address all of them ultimately. There's no question about that. Okay. That's not the only issue, though, in terms of the seismic issue, the cost of the upgrading, all of that. In addition, the particular design of this bridge interacts with the location of the lift spans and the turnstile on the railroad bridge downstream. The height of the bridge determines, you know, the height of the boats that can go underneath of it and all of those kinds of issues as well. So the current bridges are problematic not just because of the seismic kinds of issues there. But those factors certainly contribute to the ultimate decision here. Okay? And as I say, we have on the table a recommendation from the staff. Okay? A lot of the discussion about whether or not there's going to be a fourth alternative, in fact, centers around not an issue around, say, light rail versus bus rapid transit. Those issues are on the table. The discussion is whether or not we ought to have a supplemental as opposed to replacement bridge, okay? In part because of cost issues. Okay? As they say, it's not clear to us that, in fact, it will be cheaper to keep the current bridges. In fact, it may be more because of the additional land takings and so forth for the additional bridge in there. But I suspect that may very well be one of the alternatives that's on the table come next Thursday.
Well, and without an additional corridor, you're still connecting the bridge to the same pipes on each end. And so all of a sudden, you've gone like this. And so you have a lot more capacity on the bridge, but what happens when you get to the other side? I think this really relates to Senator George's earlier question.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we have Mindy Lindquist from Senator Patty Murray's office, Carmen Ford from Congressman DeFazio's office, and also to hear from Eric Chambers of Congressman Blumenauer's office. So we have other representatives in the audience. This is the important part. Senator Starr and I were at the White House last week, wasn't it, for a transportation meeting, and And it was a very fascinating 4 hours that we heard from all our federal partners about how important transportation was. And the conclusion, I think, as I got went away from the meeting was, it's really important, and you guys are smart enough to figure out how you're going to pay for it. So, fortunately, there's two branches of government, and we have a congressional branch as well. And we obviously are going, whatever the final decision is on this project, we are going to need the great support of our great mutual delegations. And so we're hopeful to hear good words. So please introduce yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Mindy Lindquist, and I'm the Southwest Washington Director for U.S. Senator Patty Murray. She's very sorry she couldn't be here today, but as a former member of the Washington State Senate, she was very happy to hear about this joint meeting, so thank you. Today, I'm going to briefly just talk about some background on the federal budget and where we are. In 2005, the Surface Transportation Committee reauthorized the transportation bill, Safety Lou, which is reauthorized until 2009. This is the mechanism that gives states federal formula money that helps fund highways. This money comes from a trust fund, which is rapidly running out of money. We don't want to wait until 2009 to address this. Senator Murray would like to see this addressed soon. Why should you care about this? This is where the Columbia Crossing money will come from. So we need to look at that. There's a lot of things affecting the federal government budget this fiscal year. We are running on a pay-as-we-go environment. There's a lot of fiscal decisions, including the wall track, that will have a direct impact on what Senator Murray will be able to deliver in discretionary funding through her position as chair of the Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee. This last week, Congress finally passed the FY07 budget. There were no earmarks in this budget. What that means is the Bush administration will have full discretion on how to fund, or full oversight on how discretionary funding is spent. Traditionally, the Senate and the House has that discretion. So for this year, the state DOTs will have to go to the Federal Highway Administration to apply for this money. What does this mean for Southwest Washington? Senator Murray was able to authorize $2 million for the Salmon Creek Interchange Project, which will take care of a bottleneck further north. That money was stripped out of there, and now the county will have to work with WashDOT and Federal Highways to get that money. Senator Murray understands how important the Columbia Crossing is, not only to Southwest Washington, but to the whole I-5 corridor. But money is getting harder to find and tighter to find. So the Columbia Crossing partners really need to work together to make sure their message is clear, concise, and consistent. She's been a supporter of the bridge and the study in the past, getting the appropriation earmarks for different studies for this. The things that she tells groups over and over again who come to her for money is, give me the information to fight for your project in D.C. I urge everyone to do that. Everyone needs to be clear, concise on what this is. A healthy discussion is good, but when speaking to your members, we all need to be clear and on the same page. The Northwest is positioned very well in Washington, D.C. Give us the tools to help you. She also wanted me to be sure to thank all the members of the task force. She knows it's a thankless job, and she just wanted to say thank you. And just to also share her dedication to this project, and we'll work with everyone to make sure that it happens. Thank you.
My name is Carmen Poore, and I'm the district director for Congressman Peter DeFazio. Thank you, Chair Haugen and Chair Metzger, for hosting us today, and thank you to both members from both the Oregon and Washington legislatures. I'd also like to thank the Port of Portland for hosting the meeting in their lovely facility, and the staff at the Oregon Department of Transportation for helping coordinate all of us in getting here today. Congressman DeFazio very much applauds the efforts of both legislatures and the leadership that both are undertaking to look at the growing congestion problems that we're facing on Interstate 5. It goes without saying, but it has been stated several times today, that Interstate 5 is a key economic link for the larger region, the Pacific Northwest, on down into California. And as such, it is the economic lifeblood for our area. But also, it does directly impact the quality of life for those who use and drive on Interstate 5 for commuting purposes as well. I think Minnie was spot on when she said that it really is key for federal members in the delegation to hear from both Oregon and Washington that a strong project is developed that has clear, direct, precise bi-state support. And definitely right now the delegation is well positioned with their specific roles in Congress to be particularly helpful on this project, as long as the local players make a compelling case. A good example in the last Safety Lou reauthorization bill was when Congressman DeFazio was able to get an additional $200 million to work on Oregon's cracked bridge problem along Interstate 5. And for the Washington partners who likely, but if you're not familiar, we were having a systems failure where bridges along the interstate were all failing at the same time. And it was sort of being punished for being efficient at the time. The Oregon Department of Transportation was very efficient in getting the bridges constructed. But by the time they were finished and California had completed theirs, technologies had changed. And so what ended up happening, at least, you know, flashing forward 40, 50 years, was that all the bridges were failing at the same time. So a lot of the congressman's counterparts in Congress, they looked at this as discrete bridge-by-bridge problems. They didn't see it as a systems failure or that it was a mega project that needed assistance. Representative Oberstar, who then was the ranking member, now is the chair of the full committee, came out at the invitation of Congressman DeFazio, and they did a tour along the interstate. And at one point, we even went on a biking tour under one of the Willamette spans with some staff at ODOT, and we had binoculars, and we're looking up, and you could see the bridge sort of expand and contract as we're standing under, and I'm thinking, I bike under this all the time. I don't You know, and he definitely caught the attention of Congressman Oberstar. I mean, it was very effective in demonstrating the real problem. But in addition to that effort and bringing Congressman Oberstar out here, the Oregon legislature and the governor stepped up in providing $3 billion of investment in transportation. And that was a very powerful message back to Congress that the state of Oregon was committed to making improvements in its transportation project. The combination of those things, a very clear need combined with local support, help Congressman DeFazio bring those additional $200 million to help fix what is a true problem along the interstate and the lifeblood for all of the states that are connected. Oops, this is what I wanted. I think you may or may not be aware, but the I-5 corridor along Oregon, Washington, and California were selected as a SAMI finalist in the U.S. Department of Transportation's Corridors of the Futures program. If Oregon and Washington are ultimately selected, you could receive special assistance from the U.S. Department of Transportation for the Columbia Crossing project. Now, it's unclear exactly what that could mean, but what this project was established to do was to help accelerate the development of multi-state and possibly multi-use transportation corridors to help reduce congestion in discrete areas. There potentially could be some monies attached to this project, and it could also mean more help in moving a project along, a potential way for to help work with the bureaucracies to move your project forward. And again, I think if selected and if the states want to move forward on something like that, that's something that Congressman DeFazio would be willing to be helpful on. So that's what I have for today, and moving along.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairwoman, legislators, thank you for the opportunity to come and speak today. My name is Eric Chambers, and I do transportation issues for Congressman Blumenauer. With your permission, I'll read a short statement from the Congressman. Dear Senators, I appreciate your special meeting on the Columbia River crossing. Your cooperation is so important, not just for the critical oversight it provides, but for the great example it sets. While my responsibilities in Washington, D.C. prevent me from attending your meeting today, I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony on the Columbia River Crossing project. Over the course of my career as an elected official, serving as a policymaker and administrator at the local, state, and now federal level, transportation has been a primary focus. There is no area of public policy, planning, or finance that provides more challenges and opportunities. Oregon's trade-dependent economy relies on a strong multimodal transportation system that has the capacity to move people and goods quickly and efficiently. Interstate 5 is the most critical West Coast route for the movement of people and freight, and the Columbia River Bridge has been a consistent bottleneck in the region. That is why I worked for light rail in the early 1990s and on the 1995 light rail campaign and have delivered $7.4 million in dedicated federal funding to the process now underway in Delta Park and the crossing area. As we look at ways to address this bottleneck and the age and seismic issues associated with the current bridge, we must develop a comprehensive solution that will not just add more lanes, but one that serves regional movement by incorporating mass transit, cycling and pedestrian needs, as well as commuter and freight traffic. I strongly support the work that is currently being conducted by Oregon and Washington, and I am confident that the eventual solution, by serving various types of modes, will make each of the modes more efficient and effective. This will probably be the largest transportation construction project in our region's history. It will need state and local funding as well as securing significant federal funding. This will require that both Oregon and Washington step up to fund the project and move forward with a realistic financing plan. There is no question that the current span needs to be addressed. It's outdated, insufficient, and potentially dangerous. The solution we pursue must be reasonable in its scope and be built with our region's economic and livability interests in mind. In order to gain financial support from Congress, Oregon and Washington will need to demonstrate that they have a realistic vision, the local resources committed to make it happen, and the ability to make a decision. I will continue to make the federal partnership one of my top priorities. I look forward to working with you on this and other items so important to the Northwest. Thank you for your concern and leadership. Signed, Earl Blumenauer.
Thank you very much. Glad to hear the word about partnership and the need for a significant federal partnership, because I think one thing we will all agree on once the ultimate decision is made is that this is a partnership. We're trying to demonstrate that together. And Ms. Lindquist, your point about being precise and specific is one thing that we are trying to move together to help our mutual delegations speak with one voice in Washington, but to recognize that transportation infrastructure is the key to both the economic and personal security of our country, and our federal partners need to be engaged as well, and our commitment is to be as well. Senator Haugen, if any comments or any?
No, I couldn't say it better than yourself. I think that's really true. I'm looking forward to the next presentation, which is going to be on innovative finance, because I think that's the bottom line for all of us. Yeah. But certainly partnerships is the way we have to go. That's how we built our funding in the state of Washington, our last funding mechanism, what's called the Partnership Act. And this is no question that we have to have partners not only at the state and local level, but the federal becomes a significant one also. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have our next presenters are going to be representatives of our two state authorities dealing with innovative finance. We have Jeff Doyle from the state of Washington and Jim Whitty from Witte from ODOT. This is Innovative Partnership.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, while they're coming up, if I could ask, are we going to have an opportunity today to hear any testimony at all from just average citizens?
We're going to try and do that. That's why we're trying to move ahead a little bit so we can do that.
Thank you. Some
people have to catch a train. So.
Well, I was aware of that, and that's why I was asking. I don't know how long. Well,
in fact, it might be a good point. We're scheduled to go to 2 o'clock. I'm thinking we're going to go to about 2:15 because I do want to get a few people who signed up from the public to testify. So and we may have some questions. So I would ask you to keep – it's always terrible when we ask you to come and you're the last panel, but to try and keep this to maybe a total of 20 minutes so we can have a few of the people who have signed up have an opportunity to address this.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Whitty, manager of the Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and update you on its status and to introduce it to some. The Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program was established by the Oregon Legislature in 2003 in order to explore non-traditional private sector generated funding and financing mechanisms for transportation projects. The Oregon Legislature at that time was willing to experiment because of the shortage of traditional revenue streams for highway capacity expansions, particularly for large projects. The authority granted by granted to the Oregon Department of Transportation is quite broad. Essentially, this is an alternative procurement process outside the traditional government procurement process. Through the Innovative Partnerships Program, ODOT, through the Oregon Transportation Commission, can accept unsolicited proposals or create solicitations where the selection of private partners can be achieved through application of best value or qualifications as opposed to low bid, which is the traditional process. Partners are able to enter at the any stage of project development, even as early as concept. The definition of transportation project is also broad, any proposed or existing undertaking that facilitates any mode of transportation. The authority, and this is very important to understand, for approving all procurements and all contracts under the program rests with the Oregon Transportation Commission. During the rulemaking process for this program, the commission expressed a strong preference for solicitation as opposed to acceptance of unsolicited proposals. And for the Columbia River Crossing, there's actually a provision in the rule that prohibits acceptance of unsolicited proposals for the Columbia River Crossing unless Oregon and Washington agree otherwise. The program began preparation for its first solicitation in the fall of 2004. We established objective criteria ahead of time for evaluating the readiness and desirability of the projects, and then through a nomination process with all of ODOT's regions and divisions, we had them nominate what they thought would be projects that might be advantaged by this process. We then put together a screening committee that represented all of those regions and divisions, ran the process, and ended up with a list of projects for solicitation that went to the ODOT director, who made a modification and then forwarded the list to the Transportation Commission. And then roughly 2 years ago, in January 2005, the commission made the necessary findings for approving solicitation for five projects, three highway, one rail, and one for maintenance stations. Then working with the ODOT regions, ODOT developed a two-stage triple procurement. What this really means is what is known as pre-development work, followed by financing, construction, and operation of new facilities. There's really two ways to engage the private sector in this way. You can do pre-development work, or you can have a hard bid. Pre-development means there's work that needs to be done before a hard bid is ready to go. In these cases, the projects we didn't believe were ready for a hard bid, so we chose the pre-development path. ODOT issued the RFP for three projects in April 2005, and they were for the Newburgh-Dundee bypass around Newburgh and Dundee in Yamhill County, the Sunrise Corridor off of 205 out through Damascus in Clackamas County, and in the south I-205 widening. There's a map and some descriptions of the projects attached to my testimony. At the same time, ODOT received special exemptions from certain federal requirements from the Federal Highway Administration because the projects were part of the federal aid system. In August 2005, ODOT received proposals on all three projects with competition on one. And following an extensive evaluation process, the Oregon Transportation Commission authorized negotiations with an entity called the Oregon Transportation Improvement Group, which is a consortium led by Macquarie Infrastructure Group, for the pre-development work, leading to a concession on the projects, potentially. And 1 year ago, after negotiations, the commission approved three pre-development agreements, and we've been working under those agreements for a year now. The compensation under the pre-development agreements is rather unique. The Oregon Transportation Improvement Group, we call it OTIG, use the acronym, is paid on a reimbursement basis for work performed, but only if there's a separation under the contract. And there is a cap on the amount reimbursed. We know we are getting value far and above the cap from the firm. Exposure overall for all three projects was $20 million. And each agreement then is divided into milestones under a defined work plan and a further refined reimbursement cap under each milestone. At the end of each milestone, either party can take an off-ramp from a particular project. So ODOT is not bound all the way through, and neither is the OTIG. Let's talk about the current status, because there's been a lot of activity in the recent months. Last December, OTIG presented a report for the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. The report assesses the project costs and compares them to potential project revenues, and this project was analyzed as a toll facility. The OTIG determined the project is feasible, but only if the new bypass and existing 99W were tolled. There still existed a significant funding gap of $150 million, and no traditional funds have yet been identified to cover that gap. ODOT has yet to decide whether to enter into the Milestone 2 on the projects, and we're kind of in a holding pattern at the moment. But we're unlikely to do so, to go into Milestone 2, until a solution is found for the funding gap and a demonstration is made that there is political acceptability for the funding and financing plan. We have plans, however, for trying to attain that. The next step for the bypass is for the ODOT's financial advisor. We hired one specifically for this purpose, Bear Stearns, to examine OTIG's traffic and revenue work and build a comparison financial models for both a private financing and a public financing. So we'll have three things to look at. We'll have the OTIG financing plan, we'll have a more objective financing plan, and we'll have a public financing plan to be able to see which one can garner the necessary level of funding and the necessary political acceptability. ODOT will then choose the most advantaged pathway for the state of Oregon, provided that one of them is viable, if not all. In January, the commission received scoping studies on the other two projects. And this is an earlier stage of development. This does not compare costs with revenues yet. So the project for the Sunrise Corridor and the South I-205 widening. The OTIG determined that the Sunrise project is not viable as a standalone public-private project. It analyzed the tolling capability as well as development charges, and simply it could not make the numbers work as a public-private arrangement. From a tolling perspective, the project is simply too short to afford the necessary time savings required for motorists to take the new facility. There are also too many alternative routes available out of the area, and there's simply not enough traffic on the existing route, so it was a three-strikes-you're-out situation. We asked them to even look at tolling existing capacity to see if that would improve the situation, and they did that, and it still did not pencil out. So what OTIG and ODOT have done is jointly take that off-ramp I talked about, and so is now not available as a public-private arrangement with OTIG. This does not mean ODOT is letting the project go, however. The project is important to the state, and we're going to look for other funding options. It might even be viable as a tolling arrangement, say, 5 or 8 years from now, once the area, which is a huge growth area for Portland, improves. But at this stage, it was necessary to take the off-ramp. OTIG determined, however, on the South I-205 project that it is viable as a public-private project, with the most likely revenue possibility being a point toll, which is a toll at one specific point on a roadway, related to expansion or replacement of the Abernathy Bridge outside Oregon City. Nevertheless, this project is very early in its other development. It has yet to start an environmental process, for example, and it is not part of the regional transportation plan yet. So the commission determined that going forward at this time is premature. It doesn't mean that it's stopped. It's just that I would call it a pause to see if it should be added to the regional transportation plan. And then following that, assuming that occurs, that the project be properly defined in a public process. ODOT has learned much from our developing our program and working with these first major public-private projects. We're more informed about how and when to select projects for procurement and how to ensure success of public-private partnerships we enter into.
Thank you. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Haugen, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Doyle. I'm our Director of Public-Private Partnerships for the Washington State DOT. And I was asked to more specifically address public-private financing options that may be available under either Washington or Oregon law. I know you have other work today on your agenda, so I'll try and be brief. If I could direct you to a chart that we prepared. It's titled Select PPP Financing Provisions under Oregon and Washington State Law. Jim has just described what we in Washington would view as a well-thought-out, successful law, administrative rules, and program. And in the state of Washington, our legislature most recently passed a new public-private partnership law in 2005 that was patterned largely after Oregon's law. The same is also true with our current administrative rules and how we are proceeding in developing a staffing structure to carry out a program. However, based on, I guess I mentioned that it was a new law, it was not our first foray in Washington State into public-private partnerships. In 1993, we actually had a public-private partnership law and a program, one of the first wave in the United States, and of course, in retrospect, it proved to be a little overly aggressive, and it didn't take long before 12 potential projects were whittled down to one, and today we have one project that was developed under that original 1993 law. That's our there were some learnings that occurred both in the department, but I think also it's fair to say among our legislature that some of the things that we did in 93 we would not repeat again as we went from 12 to one project. So particularly in the 2002 legislative session, there were significant policy debates about whether or not public or private financing is appropriate for these types of projects. The particular project that we were proceeding with is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge project. It's a toll, 100% or almost 100% toll financed project. And just to shorten the story, in that instance, it was found that if we proceeded as a public financing, we could achieve a somewhat lower toll rate structure than if we were to proceed as the project was originally negotiated back in the 1990s, which was as a public-private partnership with the emphasis being on the private financing. The project has done quite well, at least in our judgment. We haven't had a single car yet, though, that's paid a toll because the bridge won't open until later this year. So the jury's still out, really, on whether or not the financing has been as successful as we are hoping that it will be. In the meantime, though, the 2005 law incorporated, in fact, it institutionalized that financing approach for all public-private partnership projects developed under our new state law, which is to say that for any public-private partnership that we develop, a project that we develop, I should say, we must use debt if we're going to use it at all. It has to be issued by our state treasurer. And that, in effect, was an attempt to always take the policy preference towards publicly issued debt. At least, yes, that's the way that it reads, and that's what's laid out in front of you in the chart. Whereas Oregon's authorities are much more, you have more tools available to you that doesn't contain all the restrictions, Washington's law is significantly different in that regard. If I could leave you with just three brief thoughts, we're, first of all, encouraged that you've convened and that you're interested in pushing along the project. I would suggest that we not wait until the project scope has completely been defined and we have everything ready to go before we start thinking about how we're going to procure it and the way in which we're going to finance it. And if this panel is convened, either, you know, at your discretion, obviously, either later this summer or next year, we would hope to be able to come back to you and talk about, number one, who is the appropriate issuer of project debt, if there's going to be project debt, whether it's Washington, Oregon, a special purpose entity, or a private partner. Number two would be how best can we leverage construction funding for this project when we will have most likely multiple funding sources, hopefully state money from both states, hopefully federal money, also toll revenue, but perhaps even some local or regional money contributions. And then finally, sort of the wet blanket here, is that how do we make this all work if it has to comply with the more restrictive provisions under Washington law? And that's something that hopefully Jim and his staff will work with the state of Washington on this summer and come back to you and have some suggestions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you. Are there any brief questions? I do think this is the key, and I think that's the main reason that we as a bi-state legislative committee need to work together, because ultimately that's going to be the decision. I will say that Jeff has come forward this year with some recommendations to make some changes in our laws to try to make it move closer to yours, but the financing, the public versus the private financing is still going to be an issue for the state of Washington. Other questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you. And I very much appreciate your last 3 points, Mr. Doyle. I think that that's terrific, and especially the one about not waiting until the project is entirely scoped. If I'm critical at all of our Department of Transportation and our commission, it's the fact that they basically took CRC off the table from the very beginning as it relates to the office that, or the projects that Jim has oversight over. I think that we lose tremendous leverage by moving this project so far down the line before we invite the private sector into the room to talk about not only funding but actually construction and those kinds of things. So I appreciate very much, especially your first point, but I think all three are quite appropriate. Thank you.
Yes, with respect to tolling, what would be the legal hurdles that we would need to jump in order to be able to toll both the new bridge and I-205?
Well, first of all, Jim, feel free to jump in here, but 205, of course, is an existing interstate highway. There's a federal, apparent federal prohibition on that, although there may be, depending on if there were reconstruction on 205, you might be able to do something there. That's an open question. But even under the state laws, in our state, as it currently stands, the state legislature must approve the initial imposition of all tolled facilities. Now, there, I will share with you that our legislature has a bill, I believe, can't remember if it's in the House or the Senate,
House bill,
that would perhaps change that and either delegate or maybe pre-approve certain facilities for tolling. I don't know about Oregon's authorizing statute, what would have to happen to that.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we don't have the same kind of restrictions that Washington does. One thing to note, however, is that these facilities should be have a strong application of electronic tolling, and we do not in Oregon have the ability to do that effectively. We don't have the enforcement capability to do a fully electronic tolling in a way that would be effective, and so that's something that we're working on, a bill that's hopefully coming forward soon to address that issue.
And I think we will have an example in the state of Washington of an electronic tolling, because we not only are going to be doing a Narrows Bridge, but we're also doing a hot lane, which will have electronic tolling. So I think we can learn from each other. And Senator Benton, a very brief question, because we need to move on.
Yeah, I'm very cognizant of that fact, Madam Chair, but this is an important question. I'm assuming, and maybe it's wrong to assume, that any cost of this project or a third bridge across the Columbia River or any future bi-state project would be shared 50-50 between the states after federal or other sources of funding were deducted. Correct me if I'm wrong on that assumption. And then the second part of that question is, I believe Washington State has already put in $50 million towards this project. Can you tell us how much Oregon has put in to the project?
I don't know if these are the correct gentlemen.
I'm sorry, Senator. On the first, I know that there is an understanding that the toll revenues would be treated as 50-50. Beyond that, I couldn't speak to that.
So only revenues. Do we know the answers to those other questions?
I can give you a ballpark number. So I think the state of Washington has put in about somewhere around $60 million, and the state of Oregon about $12 million. Those are ballparks.
We wouldn't expect that same ratio on the actual construction, would we?
And I think that's why we're meeting jointly, because I think we both have the only responsibility to the middle of the river, and if we didn't connect, we'd have a problem.
Of course, I just want Oregon to understand that we're hoping that if there is tolling, that we'll get a credit for the $100 million a year our citizens already put into your coffers.
Well, I don't think that's where we want to start. I think we want to start on a much more positive note.
Well, one thing I would say, too.
In jest, Madam Chair.
Senator Benton and Chairwoman Haugen, part of the understanding, the agreement between Oregon and Washington, on all these bridges. In fact, every bridge over the Columbia has always been a toll bridge, and its construction has always been equally spent. We did ask that question of the Oregon Department of Transportation officials yesterday in our own committee back in Salem. Sure. And at the end of the day, it will be 50-50. But thankfully for your participation to jump ahead on the EIS with your contribution last year in your last session, the horse race is a little ahead with you, and we'll be catching up.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. What we're going to do, just to give the committee, we have a few members that will be heading back on the train. At 2:30, we're scheduled to have a brief tour, as we can see, and then there's a reception next door for us at 4:30. What I want to do now is, it is 5 minutes to 2. I want to go another 20 minutes. We have a quorum, so we're going to take action on our resolution, but I want to ask a few of the public members to come forward who have been signed up, if they're still here, and each they're given 3 minutes to do so. We have a few that have also signed up to say they have written testimony. So please submit that so all the members can have it. I'd like to ask Robert Koski, Edward Barnes, and Fred Nussbaum to come forward if they're here, and give each of you 3 minutes to provide oral testimony. If you have written testimony, please submit that as well.
And I think the conversation is the bills that we have before us?
Yes.
So I think
obviously the scope will be what we're talking about today. Now, and you are, sir?
Fred Nussbaum.
Hey, Fred. Then is Paul, because I see the other two aren't here, Paul Edgar or Jim Howell here?
Paul Edgar here?
Yes. Paul, then come forward. You're the next on that list. So welcome and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of both committees, my name is Fred Nussbaum. I am a strategic planner for the AORTA, the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates. We are a sister organization of All Aboard Washington, formerly known as WASHARP. And I am addressing the resolution before the Oregon members of this illustrious body, SJR 15. Just to start out with, AORTA does not argue the fact that there is a real and urgent need for transportation problems to be addressed across the Columbia River here in our region. And we are committed to help come up with a solution for that. What we're asking from you is to provide some guidance to the Columbia River Crossing Task Force in their deliberations as to what they're going to carry forward into the environmental assessment process as you are the representatives of the citizens of Oregon. I want to apologize to the members from Washington because my written testimony was just addressed to Oregon, but then it's Oregon's resolution. I don't know if you have a similar resolution before you, but I guess we'd ask the same from you. Since we represent not only rail passengers and transit users in Oregon, but up and down the West Coast, Pacific Northwest. So we are concerned that the Columbia River crossing process is bringing us to a place that may not be the best for the citizens of Oregon. And primarily what we're concerned about is narrowing down prematurely the options available. Now, there's been talk about there being three options. It's actually only one build option with two variants and a no-build option. And the two variants are, the one option is a 10 to 12-lane freeway bridge across the river with choices as to whether that's going to be accompanied by light rail or bus rapid transit. But it's essentially one option. It's going to have the same footprint regardless of which mode of transit is going to be used. And we're concerned that that's going to face this whole process down the line with a situation where you end up with a solution that can't be carried forward because it's unrealistic. And so we would like to see, you've heard talk now of a fourth option, and we would like the resolution that you have before you to refer to a third option. So the amendments that we provided you in a second handout there, in addition to my sort of outline there, is an amendment that would addresses that particular item, that we want to have an option in the mix. And this is similar to what you probably will be hearing from other groups, including the Metro Council is working on similar lines. We have an option that retains the freeway bridges as freeway bridges and provides a supplemental bridge. doesn't really have to do that. It has to be an option that retains the freeway bridges that addresses also the statement of purpose and so on that the task force is working on.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and thanks for the written testimony, sir. And I would ask, as he speaks, Mr. Chair, NASA could step forward.
This must be the one. Okay, thank you. My name is Paul Edgar. I've been a very active transportation advocate in this area for many, many years. And years ago, I was appointed as an alternate to the Southwest Washington Regional Transportation Council by a gentleman by the name of former Representative Tom Mielke. Tom Mielke couldn't be here, but he wanted me to make a statement, and he wanted it to be known that that he does not really support this recommendation as it's being advanced right now. And there are a lot of reasons why. But what I'd like for you to know is Tom's 8 years sitting on the House Transportation Committee in the state of Washington legislature has, in all of his participation in all of the studies over the years, has brought him to this conclusion. He just kind of said, you know, 15 years ago, I was down here with Senator Hogan. And he said that at that time, we were told that the I-5 corridor was full, that it was at that saturation point. But what he said, you know, it hasn't changed. I want to read something to you that I got from a very reliable source. And it said, Paul, while I no longer have access to information, in 1985, ODOT commissioned the consulting firm of CH2M Hill to do a draft EIS on what was called the Minnesota Freeway section of I-5. I think they may have looked at the bridges, but the EIS was focused on a freeway south of the bridges. The work stopped because it was concluded that there was no alternative that would come close to a one-to-one cost-to-benefit ratio. This 20-year-old conclusion is valid today. What that statement is the I-5 corridor, as we now know it, is broken. We could put a new CRC bridge into the mix, and we will induce more traffic into the I-5 corridor. This will create, and they have estimated, that in 2030 we will have a 6-mile-long backup lasting 14 hours a day. And that's with a brand new CRC bridge. So what are we doing? Do we need to solve a problem? And the problem is the I-5 corridor. And this particular project, as you now see it, as it is being advanced, does not solve that problem, period. Okay, end of statement.
Thank you, sir.
I did advance, and I would like very much for all of you to read this.
Your letter. Thank you.
That there are alternatives, and they are viable and workable.
Thank you. And what I would suggest also, for all the great comments that people have on this, is why they have the public process. These our respective committees are not dealing with the particulars of that to make sure that the process works so that your voice can be heard. And I would encourage you to continue to do that. I'm going to go to the next witness, please. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having your hearing today. My name is Sharon Nassett, and I have participated in the I-5 task force as well as and have come to the bi-state CRC meetings regularly. I think the statements of the first two gentlemen when they were talking about how do we move forward and that how does this process have integrity and that they asked for your discipline was absolutely on target. The problem that many of the elected officials and people who have been involved in this process have is that the NEPA process has not been followed closely. One of the things that CTRAN said in their 3-page scathing letter was that all of the information that was being used from CTRAN was being used inappropriately and was coming out with the wrong set of findings. The problems that they had were they would not change those. IORTA came forward with their project. They had information that was misleading, wrong information on what was brought forward, what the citizens brought forward. They have talked with staff several times who have intentionally not changed it and have refused to. Economic Transportation has had the same information problem that what they bring in does not come out honestly or fairly. Several citizens have that problem. I have gone to RTC, JPAC, and CRC for almost 2 years every month and mentioned to them that they are breaking Oregon meeting laws. We have a joint path. You have to respect both. In going to JPAC and RTC and saying that month after month and giving them actual situations, not once have they said, we should have a task person look into this. One of our staff members should see about all of the open meeting laws. I'm not the only person who has said that. While we are spending millions of dollars right now to attract people in, the Columbian editorial put out a thing calling us people who were coming to the process with our ideas as armchair beer-drinking Home Depot people, and that they felt sorry that ODOT had to continue listening to us. Not one agency, ODOT, WADOT, or any transportation organization here even said a statement in the paper that was inappropriate. Not one person said, at this moment, we are asking citizens to come forward. At the second hearing that we had, Rob DeGraff, the project director representing ODOT, said in his preliminary conversations with the Federal Highway, they were not only looking for a new corridor north-south to be studied, but they were expecting it, and they were looking for citizens to bring it forward in the NEPA process. It was recommended to go forward by the I-5 task force. It's in the RTP of both states and in the Metro documents. And was accepted into the NEPA process at CRC as River Crossing 14 in its entirety. The information that came out was incorrect. If they are to only be studying the I-5 bridge, which is different than what the federal government has said and that they have said in their original meetings, why would they have brought it in the beginning? The I-5 task force charged them with fixing the rail, adding access to our industrial areas, our ports, and looking at other bridge options. The discipline is needed. I am hoping to ask you today to look forward to a motion that you will take forward the steps of integrity and see that the NEPA process is looked into and that the Oregon open meeting laws that have been violated are looked at. The only way to bring everybody back into the process is to have integrity. There is nobody in this process that wants to see it go any longer than it has, because it started in 1977, and that is 30 years, not simply a decade.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm a strong supporter of the open meeting process. I'd be happy to talk to you later about that. Well, one more testimony, sir. You have a few minutes, please.
I heard my name, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair. My name is Jim Howell, and I'm here representing the Citizens for Better Transit. I was pleased to hear that possibly a fourth alternative will be looked at, because we really feel that the recommendation of staff is a 20th century solution to a 21st century problem. It does not deal with increased oil prices. It does not deal with global warming and CO2. And it basically just is more of the highway expanding mentality. As the 19th century was rail, the 20th century is highway. I really believe that the 21st century is going to be back to rail. The rail system in this country has to be greatly enhanced, both heavy rail, commuter rail, passenger, freight, and light rail. And that's where the answer lies, especially in this corridor regarding a light rail. Two light rail tracks across on a supplemental bridge would probably be in the neighborhood of 10 to 15% cost of this project and would carry the equivalent of a 10-lane freeway. It has the capacity of a 10-lane freeway. The problem is, would that capacity be utilized? According to the The modeling that was done for this project, it assumed that only, I think, roughly 20% of the commuters in 30 years will be using public transit. That's a ludicrous assumption, quite frankly. And so everything has been built off of that assumption that we're going to handle 180,000 vehicles a day across here in 20 years. And so by looking at that fourth alternative that focuses on public transit, local access, but also solve some of the basic congestion and safety problems, which can be done by some very minor improvements to ramps, it could be done. So I would like to just close in saying that we need that fourth alternative, and hopefully there'll be more public and private partnerships with the railroads.
Thank you, sir. We have time for one more testimony.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, a few more minutes. I said we'd be out 10 after. It's 9 after. Doug Allen, are you here? And then if anybody else has written testimony, please submit it. And keep in mind the participation in the process itself as it moves forward. Welcome.
Yeah, Chair and Senators, thank you very much. I won't read my written testimony. Instead, I want to draw your attention to the handout that's attached to it, which is the October 19th letter from the Metro Council to the CRC. I attended a very interesting work session of the Metro Council, which is Portland's regional government, this last Tuesday, and new Metro Council member Catherine Harrington asked Rex Burkholder, who's been Metro's representative to the CRC, what happened to the questions and recommendations and requests in this October 19th letter. And essentially, Mr. Burkholder said, they have been ignored. And the sense of the council, as I took it, was they were not pleased. They are not going to put forward a resolution in support of this single staff recommendation from the CRC. And I don't think it's appropriate at this point for the Oregon legislature to be endorsing a process which appears to be out of control and at high risk of usurping the regional priorities. The Metro Council letter was largely based on looking at matters of fiscal accountability. Where are we going to come up with this money given our regional priorities? Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Thank you for written testimony. For the record, we have a statement from Mr. Allen and the attached letter on Metro letterhead. Thank you, sir. With that, I think as we're going to go into a very brief session because we have a quorum of our Oregon Transportation Committee. We will then adjourn so that the members, our good colleagues who need to get back up on the train, can get their train. The rest of us, if you sign up, we're going to take a brief tour that will be happening right out here. I think Janet will give us the details of that. And then we'll be back at 4:30. If you could join for a reception, that would be great. This has been a real, interesting beginning for us to get some of the sense of what's going on. With that, if it's okay, Madam Chair, I would like to convene a work session on SJR 15.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the adoption of SJR 15.
Senator Starr has moved the adoption of Senate Joint Resolution 15. Members have had this to adopt to see this. Just for those who have not seen it in the audience, very specifically does not talk about what should or should not be done, but rather there are support for the process and those who are working on that process and to be supportive with our Washington counterparts on doing our role as that is deemed fit once we come to resolution. Any questions from the committee or comments? Senator George.
If I could, I'd just like to make a comment that I don't want my vote in favor of this to imply any support or opposition to any of the proposals that have been put forward by staff. I've had a few citizens bring some questions to me about the way the process works, which I'm concerned about and would like to follow up with, and some of the staff proposals that are coming forward next month. And so I just want to say that I'm supportive of the general process and moving this forward, but not I don't want my vote implied that I'm supporting anything specific coming out of staff right now.
Thank you, Senator George. Very good point. And again, I think what is really, really important is our demonstration to our Washington counterparts and everyone else that we support that process. We'll be watching that process and recognizing the importance of our responsibilities jointly to the ultimate decision, and hope that our individuals who are working on making that decision have listened to some of the comments here and going forward. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just echo the comments of Senator George, but also add that, you know, as legislators, this is comes under our responsibility to monitor and watch and guard the public, not only the public finances, but the public process as it relates to this project. And I support the resolution because it's very 10,000-foot level, and I think it's important. This project is important. Obviously, we've talked about all of the things about why the I-5 trade corridor is critically important to our economies of both of our states. But it's a 10,000-foot level support of the project. We as legislators should not and cannot neglect our duty to provide the oversight over the state agencies that are looking and working on this project.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Any other comments? Okay, is there any objection? You want to take the roll, Janet? Could you do that for us, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Deckert?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Chair Metzger?
Aye.
Majority Senate Resolution 15 is passed, and we'll go to the floor, and the chair will carry. Senator Haugen, I will leave it to you to close our meeting today.
Well, I first want to say thank you for hosting this meeting. I think this was really enlightening to myself to find out what's going on down here and know that our two states will begin to work together. And I would join Senator Starr's saying at 4,000-foot level. If we've learned nothing else in the state of Washington, we need to know that the process must work at the local level, and you must make the decisions there. I can assure you, we don't want to make the decisions at our level. It is not our role. We are policymakers, but ultimately, we are the ones that are going to have to pay for it. So it's really important that we begin to work together, and I'm looking forward to us continuing to work together in a bi-state effort to make sure that all the citizens of our states, our great states, really do benefit for whatever project moves forward. Again, thank you very much. I thank my members who came down with me. I think it's been really worthwhile for this meeting. And so with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.